the radio program, Desert Island Discs, the castaway is allowed to take away with him to the island one book, a part, it's always said, from the Bible and Shakespeare. Now, that rule was born out of people in all walks of life going onto the program over a period of years and saying, in so many cases, they would like either or both of these two books. And it's no accident that the Bible and Shakespeare were the ones chosen. These are the two most influential works in English literature, and they've moulded the thought pattern of this country. It's one of the purposes of this talk to show that Shakespeare contains nothing that is not in the Bible. That his mind and his language is saturated with Bible usage is well known to those who read the plays. But we shall be concerned in particular with that aspect of Shakespeare which shows forth the incarnate word. The word is made flesh and bodied forth on the stage in many guises in the Bard's plays. But before we go on to look at some of them, let's look at the word name of the Bard himself. To pursue a word through an etymological dictionary is one of the most rewarding things one can do. And one can gain some idea of Shakespeare's joy in word usage and word patterning by even a little of the sort of study he made of them. Of course, one has to be quite clear that Shakespeare was a reflexively self-conscious being. He didn't need to lay out the serial form and laboriously work out the subtle balances and reflections of words upon each other, which delight us in his works. There's an immediacy in his word, an altogether and each in its appropriate placeness, which defies serial analysis by a lesser mind. Because his source was the immediate, outspeaking, original word of creation, the voice that still speaks in the heart. Let's start with the two elements of his surname, Shake and Spear. To understand the name is to understand the man who answers to that name. Shakespeare himself says that good name is the immediate jewel of the soul. Shake is given in the dictionary as being from an Old English root meaning to brandish. Brandish is, of course, referent to a brand, a burning stake. But it also means to leap, to spring, or to depart, as when one shakes free of something. The feeling of the word is, the whole word that is, Shakespeare, is that the spear is being used or shaken. It is in act. It's the vibratory motion of readiness and awareness in the held spear, which one hears about in Zen. There's a subtle shake in the holding of it. In Zen, the field vibrating in the place of the weapon is the eventual thrower of the spear, because the spear is only released when the vibrations are absolutely correct and coherent throughout the field between the spear and the object which the spear is to pierce. Shakespeare's signature appears on very few documents, but it's spelt in various ways. One interesting variant on shake is shag spear. Now, this kind of variant is often put down to the fact that Shakespeare's spelling, that English spelling, rather, hadn't been standardized in Shakespeare's day. Well, maybe not. But Shakespeare was very well aware that when the word is changed, so is changed the form and the structure, the image of that which is named. Words aren't just vaguely significant utterances or squiggles on a piece of paper. They are actual power packets, involving tremendous energies in some cases. We'll talk more about that later. But for the moment, let's return to shag spear. Shag means rough and hairy, as in shaggy. Now, hair is the old HR root, with which we're all now familiar. It's differentiating power, the cause of all hierarchical activity. And hair is a symbol of this differentiating power. You also find, if you care to look them up in the dictionary, cognates in the words hairy, rough, ruach, which means spirit, rugos, which is wrinkled or differentiated. All with the same kind of differentiating power root. So we see involved in this first syllable of his name the Bard's preoccupation with the power of spirit going into a locked situation and differentiating itself. Hence the shake, the rapid tremulation or vibration with which he arms himself in the spear. The shake is the readiness for action, the tension of awareness without which there is no creative art. There is a cross-reference of that awareness, born through tension, in the second element in the bard's name. The spear is connected with certain old roots which also indicate tension, and which lie behind the Greek root sphero, a ball or sphere. There is no sphere without a pressure in upon a center, and an opposite pressure away from a center. Centripetal and centrifugal force in opposition. The opposition causes rotation, and a sphere is made. Now, every sphere is a rota, a rotation, or a tora, a law. Every rotatory sphere is a seed posited by the spirit. Hence, of course, we get the word spore. And that seed tora, that seed law, contains within itself all the necessities for development and differentiation of all its parts in a serial developmental cycle. And that is called a spoor, the track that is laid down for it, as in the spoor of the lion, etc. So we see how all these concepts, subtly interweaved, begin to create an image of this transcendental genius of wordplay called Shakespeare. He himself is born out of that source which is the positor of all seeds, the giver of the great word itself, the original seed. And seed sowing is not possible without the spear, the phallic thruster which posits the seed in the earth. Let's consider this spear function. The word is composed of three consonants, S-P-R. In every root one looks up in the dictionary, there occurs the same function, aspectually different, but essentially the same, where these letters are found. Namely, the spirit, that undulating serpent power which the shape of the letter suggests, posits, or makes a point. That point, the P, is a differentiation within the field of power, and considered as a sphere of operation, it differentiates itself, it rrrrs itself, within its own boundary or firmament. So we have the spirit positing and differentiating within the sphere that it's posited. Now, what causes this differentiation? Well, that is the will. In will, I am, Shakespeare. The great I, the absolute I, is signified in Hebrew by the 16th letter, Ayin. It's what Burma calls the Wunderauge, the wonder eye. Its will is to substantialize itself so that it may see itself. I will am. And here we mustn't confuse substance with matter. Substance, by substance, is meant merely what stands under. It's the tension in the field which causes appearance. It is not gross matter. So I will am. I will substance. Bonus says mysteriously that the Wunderauge's glance is the cause of all things. Let's look here at the wonderful symmetry of some of these words we've been using. The glance goes out from the absolute eye. Now the glance is a gay lance, a glance, the same lance that appears on Shakespeare's shield and in his name, the spear in Shakespeare. But there's another cross-reference here with the shake part, because one of the meanings of shake is to depart, to leap, or to spring forth, as we said. And the variant, shag, is cognate with a Norse word, skeg, a vowel change, and a consonant change from H to K. And it means, this word skeg, to jut out, to project, or throw forth. Again, the link with Shakespeare, meaning to throw the spear. Now, all projection, all throwing forth, in fact, all motion whatever, is seen in the type of opposition we have already seen in the positing of a sphere point, or spear point, if you like. Namely, an opposition within a field which causes rotation. Now, if we translate through space that rotation, we have what's called a spiral, The spiral is the spring in which lies coiled the stored energy of projection. And we said that the German for wonder eye, the absolute observer, is Wunderauge. That Wunderauge is a spiraline instrument. And its origin is this. The intent of the field, that is, of the absolute eye, intends to a point, a zone which is the beginning. In the beginning was the word. This spiraling in to a point of intent is in fact the first word, the first outspeaking. And that peak in speak is the same as the word pike, which is the spear again in Shakespeare. Let's pursue this SPR route in the spear. What about, for instance, the word spur? Now, spear and spurn and spur come from identical roots. All have to do with kicking or pushing away with the foot. The foot, of course, is a euphemism for that pedal extremity which made the original fuss, the great stirrer up of the world, the beginning of the turba, the phallos, the shining one. And its echoes are still in our everyday speech. To kick into life, for instance. What is this kick but a starting up of the dull backside of the world into life? If one looks up kick in the dictionary, we'll find it to be etim dub, meaning that there is power locked up in it. It's a trick. But if we change that K into gay and make the kick a gross material fact by voicing the consonants, we get the word gig from kick. Now, a gig means variously a spinning or whipping top, also a kind of harpoon, the spear again, you see, and also a lively dance. Oh, and it's also a revolving toothed cylinder used for teasing woolen fabrics. Does that make us scratch our woolly heads a bit? That cylinder with spikes in it, when placed on the foot, the phallic euphemism, is the rowel on a spur. And we're back again with the SPR route. A spur is the acceleration imparted into the horse's progress, and the lively jig or gig the beast makes when God the rider digs his heels in. So all spirited aspiration, note all the SPR roots there, all coiling, twisting, intention, all sperming, spearing, and sphering, all springing, speaking, and piking, is in the name of Shakespeare. Now, do we feel so far the joy there is in finding all these cross-references, the laughter that arises when these words come together into a pattern of meaning, a concourse of sweet sounds? Even in so little time as an hour of work on one word, the number of related concepts that appears causes that laughter at the great joke to rise up inside. The joy is that affirmation of the divine jo or yo, like in the word yo-yo. It's the spinning in and out of significances, each one kicking the mind and spurring it to another track to find the seed word. That's the joy of language that Shakespeare's whole being was dedicated to. All his work is filled with a kind of cross-references and hints at the logoic game of life in which we're all engaged, and that at least some of his contemporaries had an inkling of what he was up to, is shown in his title, The Swan of Avon. The swan is a hierarchical bird, always associated in heraldry and in mythology with the virtue of the pure knight and of the priest king. It's the bird of God, the Hun, or here and now absolute. And incidentally, the Queen's mark for her swans, you know, the swan-upping ceremony on the Thames every year, the Queen's mark for her swans is very almost the equivalent of the Hebrew letter Chet. Food for thought. This bird of God, the Han bird, is also closely associated with the Sanskrit word for sound, svanati. Svanas is Sanskrit for tone, and the Latin equivalent is sonus, You find the same word in Italian, suono. This is a reference to the universe as a product of sound or tone. So it's not an accident that Shakespeare is called the swan. The sun in Sonus is that same being whom John calls the Logos, the outspeaking word. And note too that in the myth, Zeus, or God considered as the field of absolute power, mobilized and zealously active, which is a hint at the asper root in that spear part of Shakespeare's name, comes down, if you remember, in the form of a swan to impregnate Leda, which is another reference to the impregnating word as part of Shakespeare's swan function. Now, this Shakespeare swan is of Avon. Avon. Av is a primitive root meaning appetite for development. We find it in the term avid. And the Avon is the serpent. The on is the serpent. The Avon is the serpent with the developmental appetite. By a simple sound shift from V to B, we get Ab-on, the father serpent, which means the same thing. Now if we turn the word round and read it Hebraica, we get Nova, to make new. Behold, I make all things new. In other words, we live in a dynamic field of outspeaking, seed-forming power. We never bathe in the same river twice. It's a dynamic function. Not even the Avon River. This process that we've been talking about, that of the absolute sentient power winding into a center and positing a word or world, is implied again in the word serpent. This Avon serpent. In the absolute, the serpent is called Ananda. That an-an-an-an-an is the undulating serpent. It's really the letter S on its side. Hence the serpent always says S, sound and function being synonymous. Now, in order that the world might appear, the undulating translating serpent must turn round on itself and make a sphere or a spear. It must take its tail into its mouth and become not an, which it is when it's undulating, but on. That is, it takes its tail into its mouth and makes a sphere. It bites itself. That is the beginning. In the German, it becomes clear in the word Anfang, which means beginning. Anfang, to bite itself. In the beginning was the word, and it was made by the absolute An, sinking its fangs into its own tail. Like getting your teeth into a good story, you know? The An catches itself between the teeth and stimulates itself to go round. The tail tries to get away from the bite, and so the go-round is established. The go-round, the ground. It's another way of putting Burma's statement that the Jupiter, or the will to the absolute An, tries to escape from the Saturn, or the biting will, to on-go. So, this S, in order to or differentiate itself, must be pent up, self-pent, put in a pen. It is now penis, penis. And it's curious that that pen root appears both in the head, as in pensive, and in the tail. Penis means tail, and appears in the word pendant, hanging on, dependent on. In that penitential act, all mankind subsists. It's the absolute creating a rotating sphere, that is a punct or a jot, in throne within itself, and going in with its energy into that pen, that closed-in place, to work out a process. Working out of the process is the penitential part of it. Now, in the source of all Shakespeare's works, which deeply is the Bible, we find that after the fall, the serpent is made to creep upon the go-round, the ground, which has been made. That's to say, he is crippled or impeded. Impedance makes slow. The spirit is slowed. The spirit is brought low. Now, that serpent is Satan or Saturn, the crippled old man of time. But Saturn is only the absolute winding in. To cripple is to twist. So now the absolute has become a servant, hasn't he? But a servant is a very special function. Christ taught that it was the highest function of a man towards his fellow men. Now in Hebrew, a servant is called abad, from a prime root meaning simply to work, which shows why God becomes a servant. God is the first worker. Now in Greek, the word for a servant is doulos, and we see thereby that dollar, or dolefulness, and the Yankee dollar, comes in the binding. To be sad is to be in existence, to be bound. That word existence comes out of the sixfold tension, the wheel of life. But the joke inside the sadness and the joy comes in looking further into the root and seeing that the Greek word for binding or committing into servitude is, behold, Deo, D-E-O, God himself. So what is doleful when conceived of as being imposed on one becomes joy when it's realized that one's really imposing on oneself, because one is God in act in that place. So it becomes joy when it's realized that all service is God's service. It's the joy of getting down to work. And to this end, to word or to speak means to work. Word and work are the same process. Which brings us, inevitably, back to the drama. When Shakespeare talks about the wooden O and the theatre as a stage upon which actions are performed, when he says, suit the action to the word and the word to the action, he's not being merely amusingly clever in words. He's speaking a profound truth. The word is the act. The act is a word. The SPR function proves it. The spear is an outspeaking shaft of light from the absolute eye, coning in on a point of intention, which is an expression. Outpressed, outspoken, a word. Not for nothing do we take the Latin for word, that is, verbum, and make it that part of speech called the verb, which, and I quote, expresses existence or action and affirms or predicates that a person or thing is, does, or suffers something, which is what we've been talking about. Now, in this sense, the world is the outspoken word or verbum fiat, the word deed of the absolute. The L in world shows that the word binds a zone and stimulates it to differentiate and order, the same ord as in word, order what is within that prescription. Now there is another link in the chain of meaning there, because to prescribe or to before write down. The logos or the word is outspoken from the beginning and is a continuous and continuing speaking. The world is torn out of the field, which is why to write or to scribe meant originally just that, to tear or scratch with a pen or penis. In the same way, a secretary means a cutter out. Let us just once again go through a process of examination of a significant sound sequence deed. Word, in Old English, meant what is said. It wasn't confined to one single combination of letters. We've seen that in Latin it means to be and to do. And the Greeks too, of course, have a word for it. Their word for speech was chresis, R-H-E-S-I-S. And he who spoke it was a rhetor, R-H-E-T-O-R, as in rhetoric. Now the root R-H-E means to flow. So chresis is the continuous flow of essence, the never-ceasing establishing of the world by the absolute's intentional power. His reasonable word continuously empowers the world. We are speared by his eye. As orator, he's known to the Greeks, as we've said, as rhetor, R-H-E-T-O-R, namely, that differentiating power of the field who establishes by his speaking doing the existential world. Now, the Sanskrit equivalent says very much the same, vratam. It means order, command, law. In Old Slavic, it's even more obvious, rota. The law aspect is the wall, law wall, made in the field by the continuous rotor or word work which keeps the sphere in motion. Now, it's pretty obvious that the word order has to do both with world and word. It's marked etym dub in the dictionary because in any governmental system, the keeping of order is vital. Hence, its sound meaning in the original must be covered up. Although the word origin itself gives the game away. For is not a gin a trap? The same trap as the gin in beginning? And the OR is the core of the mater. We find OR in the term oral, meaning in the mouth. Now, speech of any kind is impossible of amplification without a sphere. To amplify is to make substantial the enfolded significances of the eternal. Substance is a statement of resistance caused by opposition, the opposition of Jupiter-Saturn, which brings the sphere to being in the first place. The mouth, the book, the theatre, the word, the world, all have a likeness to this original O, this first closure of the field to make a mouth. Through internal oppositions within this oral cavity, all sound is articulated. That articulation is the vibration. It's caused by opposing the roof of the mouth and the tongue to obstruct the passage of breath in the word rrrr, for instance. Now, the significances here are fairly clear, are they not? The mouth is the intentional zone of action of the tongue. The tongue itself is the lingam, the member, the original member who talks the lingo. It's the likeness in the head of the phallic interjection, which again is that SPR function in Shakespeare. The breath in the process is the originating cause or spirit. Before it creates the phallic logos, we have to call it spiri. The spiraline intent. It's the St. John reference again, to the wind, to wind, to twist and to blow. The spirit blows where it lists, because it's a wind or wind. It's the spiraline intent of the absolute to manifest. Again, it's SPR. If we call the phallic tongue the eye, and the created receptacle or womb into which the phallus spears, the O, we have that I-O function, which we've talked about at length on previous occasions. If we put a circle down to represent the O, and put the I centrally down it to divide it and lengthen it so that the ends of the I are outside the circle, we have that ancient mnemonic toy carefully hidden in a child's plaything called the yo-yo. And it's also a drawing of a sperm, which is our old friend SPR, sperm, working in the substantial M again, spurred on by a divine acceleration or kick from the coiled spring to develop the egg of being. The will to develop is, of course, the function of love, about which we shall hear more later. To go back to the tongue in the mouth, the tongue rising in the mouth to differentiate the sound and to voice it is why OR, that is O, the mouth, R, the differentiation, is taken to mean to rise up in words like oriri and orient. When the whole sphere, the whole O, is permeated with the conscious realization of the vibratory pattern of significances, which the R is, then we truly say of such a person, he has a golden voice, an OR voice. And sometimes we call it his master's voice, don't we? Voice is vox. Develop the turning sphere of the word. Or, O-R, is the word for the metal gold, which is alchemically associated, incidentally, with the sun, or son, or sound, or logos sphere, which differentiates the earth. To say that the sun differentiates the earth is the same as saying that the phallos differentiates the expectant O. The same as saying that to hear is to obey the spoken command of the logos. It's not an accident either that oral sounds in speech like A-U-R-A-L. So you have O-R-A-L, oral, and A-U-R-A-L, oral. And if we go back for a moment to the word vox, that is the development of the ox by significant sound, then we see the word aurox. Then we have the same image, because aurox is another word for the ox, the turning sphere. But here we have that aur root. So the ox here is listening to the word and being differentiated and developed by its vibrations. So to hear is to obey. All order is dependent on hearing. Hear, O Israel, is the first commandment, the first word of command made by the Absolute to his created sphere. All instruction, all making of internal patterns, is through hearing. The incoming sound wave actually strikes the body and vibrates the soul. It resonates in the flesh and makes for itself a row, if you like, a furrow or routine significance, like a gramophone record, and in this manner it orders the substance. And of all hearing in the body's earth, the heart is the most sensitive to the whisper of the insisting spirit. The chamber of the hearing in the heart is called the auricle. The auricle, which the Greeks consulted, is much the same function. Only by hearing the secret voice of the Spirit in the oracle of the heart can one become an oracle, or speaker out of the message of God to man. Which brings us back again to the function of the Bard of Abon. All functions are either negative or positive, or more probably, they're all negative and positive at once. We may interpret the word bard as Ba-di, that is, the son of Dalet, and Dalet is a function of the Logos, because it means door, and the Logos is the door which opens when it is knocked upon, and so is the bard. In ancient times, he was a highly important figure. It was the bard who composed the songs which told the story of history and imparted the victories as he willed. The bards indeed would arrange beforehand who would win or lose. And their later descendants, that is, the heralds, were the carriers of the word between nations. It was more than a king's throne was worth to ill-use a herald, so important was he in the hierarchy of things. He was the carrier of the word. And again, this is a likeness to the Logos. The herald of the gods is Mercury. Mercury, Hermes, Thoth, and Christ are the same figure in different aspects. And so it is with the Bard of Avon. He is the great interpreter of the opera, the work done by the word. Shakespeare is the greatest singer of songs in the English language. He, more than any other book except the Bible, has moulded the English character. And even those who loathe him from their early miseducation in school are influenced, willy-nilly, by Shakespeare's plays. To such as approach him in the spirit of knocking, to be open to, he is the Bardi, the son of the door, to understanding of the sonde-struction of all things. Conversely, to those who seek him with anything else but love, he is Bard, B-A-R-R-E-D. Then indeed he becomes a bar, a rod, who rules but does not explain the law by which he rules. We've heard it said many times by Eugene that there's nothing in Shakespeare which is not in the Bible. The Bible is the book of the word, God's holy writ, in which is written the original record of the processes of the SPR function. As such, it stands at the head. It is the lawgiver. The law receiver is the willing heart. What is heard in the heart is the true logos, the still, quiet voice, the oracle in the oracle. Such a heart is the hearth stone for the fire, and that fire is the PR root in the SPR. So in English, Shakespeare is the heart of the word. In the heart, the word is called love, which is to say that the seed, that's the O in love, is wound in by the absolute sentient power until it becomes bound, where the B is Beth, a house of being. In that place, the absolute sentient power develops its intent until it incandesces and shines its own sun, or sond, back into the field, thus enriching the whole. As to the whole process, it is love, As to the developmental, from the intentional sphere back into the field of the absolute, it is called evolution. And evol is love read Hebraica. Now the all, or the oil in love, that L-O, is the function of Venus. She is what Burma calls the sweetness, which mitigates the harshness of the spiritus asper, that's the rough, hairy aspect of the SBR function. And here, let us look at another strange aspect of the word as pursued through the Wild. The Wild's English Dictionary, in this case. The SPR function has two aspects, summed up in the word spare, S-P-A-R-E. In one sense, to be spare is to be thin, frugal, sparse. That is the concentrated asperity aspect of the SPR. But to spare also means to save, does it not? It's cognizant with mercy, and according to Shakespeare, mercy is the sweet, the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It's the sweet water, the oil of Venus again, having mercy or sparing the being from the dry, harsh drive for significance in the spear. So love is male-female, all in one. It's the dry aspect, the harsh drive into significance, and the oil which mollifies the drive. And the dialectical process which keeps up the intent in the field is the interaction of these two. Without the fierce drive to make the flesh significant, we should be clay. Without the gentle willingness to serve and to soothe the way, we should be consumed in the fire of that burning brand. That is why the Merchant of Venice is so important, and why it sums up the logoic function. It also brings us to the last part of our title tonight, the incarnate Word, the Word made flesh. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us to remind us of the whole Word. Because while we remain identified with our serfdom, our slavery to what we consider is imposed upon us, then we remain in ignorance, and we cannot be true servants of the Word. When the sphere is created by the SPR coning in onto a point, the turning of the sphere many times repeated is a law which we learn by rote, by turning with it, turning it over in our minds, engramming it into our system. And in this process we are established, but we are established also in a routine. It's a habit, and it disguises us from our naked, true selves as clothes do the flesh disguise. And while we're taken in by the outward habit, the outward garment of reality, we cannot hear what is said in the naked heart. Then we become like the soul in Shakespeare's sonnet, "Poor soul, the center of my sinful earth." Note there that this is the corrupt earth, or the organ of receptive hearing. This earth is hearing only partials, not the whole mighty chord of the creative word. This, in other words, is peripheral hearing. He goes on, "Fooled by these rebel powers that thee array, why dost thou pine within and suffer dearth, painting thy outward walls so costly gay?" Note again that ear in the word dearth. In this case, it's the divided ear, which hears only the spare, frugal, partial words coming to it from the partial world. The world, this world of earth, was in the shape that Shakespeare describes immediately prior to the incarnation of Jesus Christ. The world then was so identified with the outward show, the walls, instead of the divine law which set the walls up, that the starving, spare soul echoed back to God the word he had spoken, and, as the book says, the whole world cried out for deliverance. Now that cry is the termination of the supremacy of Saturn-Satan, the compressor aspect of the field. When the stress on the outward world brings the soul receiver of the word to the point of expiration, it makes its own word call to be developed to the point where it can feed on the eternal word from which it originated. At that point, the word is made flesh. Christ comes into the earth to show the whole process of the Logos. The power which binds the O into a conceptual sphere or word, and thereby commits it to work and to organize itself, also contains at its center the comprehender of the whole process, the microcosmic eye, the dot, which knows the macrocosmic eye, the great Wunderauge. Now that seed O, the compressed O at the center of the wheel, is the savior of the whole wheel when it reveals to itself that it is not different from the power which bound it. By his crucifixion, going down into the death of the earth, and then bringing himself up again and raising himself into heaven transcendent, Christ shows man the way to complete the process. He gives to man the keys of loosing and binding. And the whole process of that is seen in The Merchant of Venice. Portia is the door of the Logos, which is locked until man has the right key. Until then, the door is barred, locked. And the lock is the shy lock. And S-H-Y in Shylock here means that the sentient power of the Absolute is affirming the lock. So he insists in the character of Shylock on his pound of flesh. A pound is where we are impounded, held in, so that we may ponder and be ground to a fine pounce or powder. The word pound, in the sense of being struck, is akin to pounce, which is a term in falconry. And incidentally, Shakespeare's crest is a falcon. Only then, when we're ground down to pounce, do we appreciate that all is not gold that glisters in the outward show. Only then do we reject the pride of intellect, which is symbolized by the silver casket. Only then do we come at last to realize that the worst, the fallen, is the best in disguise. That base, fallen lead is Saturn, and Saturn is Satan, the thrown-down spear, the appointed one who accuses or stimulates the earth to hear again. Then, and only then, does the lock of the S-H-Y reverse, and lead leads out again to the Y-H-S. That's shy in reverse. Y-H-S, the affirmation of the power of which the word is the manifestation. I-H-S is another term for Christ. The Portia is then opened to he who has attained the recognition of his basic health, basic sanity. That's the meaning of the word basanio, basic health. And it's the mercy of which Portia speaks which allows the lock to be oiled and opened. The harsh dryness of the law which Shylock embodies must be sweetened with the oil of love before man can enter into the word. But the love will of God insists in the whole process. The pyrodigal sun, or the spirit PRing and dividing itself by making a separative wheel of being, which is what prodigal means, is sent out or thrown down with his inheritance, which means his own proper word, that which is unique to himself, and he expends it. He has to expend or hang it on the outward walls, as Macbeth would say. The prodigal son goes out to the periphery and starves his own center by feeding the willful ignorance, the pigs, which comes from identification with outward show. The ignorance and the stubborn persistence in that activity are the pigs amongst whom he falls. And dialectically, that same stubborn intent is the same quality which turns him from a swine into a swain. And swain is another word for lover. So in this same way, Bassanio is the prodigal who spends his inheritance, and only when it's gone, turns to the idea of returning via his own heart center to his father. Now, without mercy, that return is impossible. And this is why the mercy speech in The Merchant of Venice is so important. You remember it too well for me to go through it all over again. But you will remember that, amongst other things, it is enthroned in the heart of kings. Because no man is truly a king, a König, or Knoa, unless he hears within his heart. It's like the eyes of the father in Eugene's drawing, which many of us have seen. The one eye is bright and hard, the ayin, or the glance, the galance of power that says, get on with it, my prodigal son, you shall not escape until you have paid the uttermost farthing. And the other eye is soft and full of love and sorrow for the pain he is inflicting. Yet his mercilessness in the dialectics of the process is a mercy in its way. And all too often, love is constrained to mean the indulgence of oneself or others in stubborn piggery. Who knows the truth of it? Only the heart, where one's true inheritance lies. Inheritance is what one inwardly hears, the in-hearing in the heart center. It's the word which, constant reiterated, maintains each man's being and is his unique fiat to life. There's no time tonight to go back again into the scene in which Bassanio wins Portia, when they both speak of that wild of no thing save of joy in which they're both bathed. But read it for yourselves and contemplate that joy they mention so often in the scene. In Latin, joy is spelt gaud, as in gaudy, G-A-U-D, a piece of tasteless or showy finery. The Romans were a materialistic people, concerned only with the law and taxes. Now in Greek, the word becomes getheo, G-E-T-H-E-O, to rejoice. The gay, that's the earth, realizes the theo, the theo, or the God word within. And they also have in Greek garos, G-A-U-R-O-S, meaning proud. And that means that the gay, or the earth, or the flesh, has developed and risen through the ros, the developing wheel. Our word joy is the affirmation of the whole process in the substantial sphere, and the light, or delight, which arises in the integration of the whole in the light of intelligence, the absolute intelligence. One might say one is joyful when one sees that, like a yo-yo, we are thrown down and we rise again on the string, which is the spirit Torah-ing, that's Torah-inge, the spirit Torah-inge, the spirit working in the earth. But up or down, the affirmation that it is the same power that lifts us or let us fall, and that we are that power, is joy. And then the yo-yo becomes a ho-ho. There's no play of Shakespeare's in which this process of the spear, the S-P-R, doesn't manifest itself. There's no play in which either the whole or some aspect of the Christ story is not played out on the word stage. We see it in Macbeth, Hamlet, Lear, in all the tragic figures. We see it in the dialectical love play of his men and women. We see it played out in the power game of the histories, and in the comedies his fools hint at it with the laughter of power which rises in the knowing of the true nature of the word game. Babel, or Scrabble, it's all one. Time and again, the prodigal's progress is hinted at. In the first part of King Henry IV, Prince Hal, Prince Henry, which is in itself a power name, gives away the whole process. In terms of his own behavior, he explains the whole process of the prodigal coning in and out again back to the infinite. The hiding of the glory of the absolute in the particular, and the particular eventually resounding the glory of the absolute back to its source. When his folly-fallen companions have departed about their nefarious business, he who has pretended to be one of them says, I know you all, and will a while uphold the unyoked humor of your idleness. Yet herein will I imitate the sun, who doth permit the base, contagious clouds to smother up his beauty from the world, that when he please again to be himself, being wanted, he may be more wondered at
by breaking through the foul and ugly mists of vapors that did seem to strangle him. If all the year were playing holy days, to sport would be as tedious as to work. But when they seldom come, they wished for come, and no thing pleaseth but rare accidents. So when this loose behavior I throw off, and pay the debt I never promised, by how much better than my word I am, by so much I shall falsify men's hopes, and like bright metal on a sullen ground, my reformation glittering o'er my fault, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off. I'll so offend to make offense a skill, redeeming time when men least think I will. And there's a reference at the end, redeeming time when men least think I will, to the fact that man had better watch, for no man knows when the Lord comes. He'll come in the night. And that's a statement of the conscious prodigal, that being who consciously thrusts himself down, who covers up his true origin, his true glory, and then reveals himself again, and by so doing, like his original prodigal counterpart, he revivifies, he reconceives the whole process, and makes the earth praise the Lord. And when, in fact, he does reconceive himself, and brings his son forth from the base contagious clouds which have covered up his glory, he does so to such great effect that at the beginning of Henry V, that is, after the king is crowned, after the son has been crowned with glory and the earth has been transformed, a likeness again of the original prodigal, the Archbishop of Canterbury himself says, "The courses of his youth promised it not. The breath no sooner left his father's body, but that his wildness, mortified in him, seemed to die too. Yea, at that very moment, consideration like an angel came and whipped the offending Adam out of him, leaving his body as a paradise to envelop and contain celestial spirits." And that is a complete statement, in fact, of the earth reconceived, incandesced, transfigured again, as Christ is transfigured when he comes up through the darkness of death back to the light. His body is made new, all drossness, all grossness purged away. But perhaps the whole process is most notably explained in The Tempest. It's reputed, of course, to be the Bard's last play, although dialectically it's always the first play in any collected edition of the works. But it certainly sums up his whole work, his life's work, of expounding the incarnated word. The very title, The Tempest, the time play, time is tempest, and the pun on the storm of life, tells us what it's about. It's very often imagined that in the person of Prospero, the main figure in The Tempest, Shakespeare is saying goodbye to the stage which he'd filled during his career with wonderful words. Well, that's as may be. But the name contains the essence of the game. So, Pro Espero, note that Espero, the S-P-R root again. Pro Espero, which means for aspiration, for hope. Both interpretations fit it very well. Is the key to the whole process. The Espero is another cunning example of that spear root again, twisting, spiraling, the outspoken word, finally dissolving again, in the sense of Prospero's name, into the great O, the O in Prospero, which is the plenum void, the full emptiness which is in fact the concrete reality, the noumenon, of which the world we see with the outward eye is a mere phenomenon. It's a mere shadow play. In fact, Macbeth, in his despair and disgust with life, puts that negative interpretation on the shadow play, which is a product of his own despair and disgust with the darkness and the bloodiness and the emptiness of his life. He says, "Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." Which again is an exact metaphysical statement of the whole process, but seen from the negative and despairing soul's point of view. In fact, he says a little bit later on that he's so weary of the whole business of life that "I begin to be aweary of the sun and wish the estate of the world were now undone," which is the negative equivalent of Prospero's winding up the time play. But Proespero the magician tells the same tale from another point of view. Prospero has gone through this whole process of Espero, of the spirit forging itself a weapon to thrust down into the bag of its own mysteries, the sack which it shakes and brings forth its mysteries from. Proespero's study of the word in act has taught him all the secrets of the magical process. It is all written, and remember, written means to inscribe or to scratch into the substance. It is all written in his great book. And in this sense, he is God the Father, the author, the begetter of the outspoken word, writing it down in his Bible. His work is his word. And really, his book is his body, his fleshly vehicle, the incarnation of his word, the inheard word of his original inheritance. Now, Proespero's version of Macbeth's tale is more merciful, more loving. He is aware that the whole process is a phenomenal appearance, that the reality lies in the noumenon beyond, and that this world is an appearance wrought by the work in a closed sphere of the creative word of God. And he says, towards the end of the play, "You do look, my son, in a moved sort, as if you were dismayed. Be cheerful, sir. Our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And, like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a wreck behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep." And a little later on, Prospero, having explained, in effect, the transient nature of this world as against the eternal word of God, releases all the prisoners on whom he has imposed his spell, his word spell, from this magic island of visions and pageants, which is the world. He releases them all. And he says, the charm dissolves apace. That is the charm or the karmic sphere. And as the morning steals upon the night, melting the darkness, so their rising senses begin to chase the ignorant fumes that mantle their clearer reason. And this is the same process that Hal is talking about when he talks about the sun, the solo, the sol, coming from behind the clouds again and shining forth on the world and transfiguring it. So these men, with their rising senses, their clearer reason, whisk away the ignorant fumes that mantle their true nature being. And the great globe that he's talking about is the G-lobe. And that lobe or lob root is the same word as lub, L-U-B, the great lubricator of the wheel. The great lubricator of the wheel is a simple sound shift to V, thus giving us the word L-U-V. Now, that's not the southern lav, which washes it all away. It's the northern basic oil of love, which allows the development of the potential of the whole system. In that sense, the gay lobe that Prospero is talking about is the earth, which is the gay, the gimel, which has been loved or lobed by God as his only begotten. That B in lobe is a house which has been laid down, encircled, enfolded by love, the only begotten of God. That love which evolved the globe is now the praise which raised it, sung back again into the source from which it came. So the earth realizes its origin and sings the praise which raises it back into its source. And that singing is the singing of the spheres which Pythagoras was really talking about. As the Bible says, the whole earth shall praise him. Now, you'll remember that on his magic island, his body sphere, or his little world, Proespero has ordered all his energies. He's made a hierarchy of all his functions. And one of them is Caliban. Now, Caliban, as you know, is a monster to whom Prospero, at one point in the play, says this:
when thou didst not, savage, know thine own meaning, but wouldst gabble like a thing most brutish, I endowed thy purposes with words that gave them meaning.
Which is a pretty broad hint that man is a beast unless his purposes are endowed with words. We know perfectly well that no one can reason, no one can think, no one can articulate his purposes unless he has a vocabulary, unless he has a system of words which are appropriate to the functions which accompany them. In this sense, man then becomes truly a counter, an evaluator of the world. The sovereign word of God. The magician gives words or ordering commands, as God did, to the unformulated and therefore dumb powers of the field, and endows their purposes with significance. Then, when the process is completed, Prospero, Proespero, the original Esperantist, speaks the word that releases all the miscreants who've been enspelled by him. And the magician is, therefore, a being who knows how to spell. He says, they being penitent, the sole drift of my purpose doth extend not a frown further. In other words, those who are tent in the pen, those who are held by the pen of the word maker, are to be released when the whole process is ended. And it's called being wound up, winding up the world as against the winding down onto the point which began the whole process. And at that point, Pro Espero speaks his great abjuration of his magical powers and of the phenomenal world which he has created.
Ye elves of hills, brooks, standing lakes and groves, and ye that on the sands with printless foot do chase the ebbing Neptune and do fly him when he comes back, you demi-puppets that by moonshine do the green sour ringlets make whereof the ewe not bites, and you whose pastime is to make midnight mushrooms, that rejoice to hear the solemn curfew, by whose aid, weak masters though ye be, I have bedimmed the noontide sun, called forth the mutinous winds, and twixt the green sea and the azured vault set roaring war. To the dread rattling thunder have I given fire and rifted Jove's stout oak with his own bolt. The strong-based promontory have I made shake, and by the spurs plucked up the pine and cedar. Graves at my command have waked their sleepers, oped and let them forth by my so potent art. But this rough magic I here abjure, and when I have required some heavenly music, which even now I do, to work mine end upon their senses that this airy charm is for, I'll break my staff, bury it certain fathoms in the earth, and deeper than did ever plummet sound. I'll drown my book.
Again, that speech repays deep and long study. Several lectures could be written on the meanings of the words and the word relations contained within it. That interpretation can be left to your further study. In any case, what I would have said and what I have said cannot ever be the definitive statement. If this talk were to be given again, it would be given at another time and at another place, because we don't bathe in the same river twice. We would all be different by however many word experiences we had gone through in the meantime. Therefore, the words spoken on this same subject would be different ones, showing different aspects of this mystery, this my story of the serpent with tail in mouth. But then that's one of the joys of word play, that it is not a static concept, a word. If a word is looked up in the dictionary and carried back to its root meaning insofar as this can be done, and felt about and worked on, and a final definitive meaning is arrived at, and the finder then rests secure in the meaning of that word, he is dead, and the word dies with him. Because the word is constantly outspoken, it's a continuous statement of a dynamic intention of the spirit into a particular situation. And therefore, all the other particular situations which come together in one place, all of which are word situations, word meanings, word powers, alter and qualify the actual meaning of the word that you are finding, and alter its aspectual relationships so that you have a living, moving harmony of sound which cannot be pinned down to a single note, or, if one does, it dies. So, wordplay is exactly what it means. A playing, an implicating and explicating of meanings. And it is a joy. But when the magician has broken his staff, or his shaft, of positing power seeds, it wasn't entirely a joke that Shakespeare was called by one of his contemporaries Shakeshaft, or he who shakes the seeds from his shaft into the earth. The magician has broken his staff and drowned his book, and there's a subtle joke. Because to drown comes from a root meaning to drink. When the magician has drunk his own expressed words again and hidden his manifested body of experienced words, those words which he has thrown out, projected forth, then the book of his fleshly body, hidden deep in the fundamental void from which the words which compose his fleshly body have come, then the play is over. Shakespeare's work is done, and he can rest. And so at this point do I, in the hope that such poor power of mine in words has conveyed to you, however dimly, and there must have been conveyed dimly in the sense that unless one is reflexively self-conscious and has the power and the conscious awareness of Shakespeare's reflexive mind, then any interpretation must be dim by comparison with the reality of his glory. So however dimly, I hope that some of the pure joy of delving into the depths of the word which Shakespeare knew and incarnated so cunningly has come across to you and will stimulate you also in the play of The Tempest and of the incarnation of the absolute into time, which properly conceived is pure joy. I'll leave you with the epilogue, Pro Espero's last word. Now my charms are all o'erthrown, and what strength I have's mine own, which is most faint. Now 'tis true I must be here confined by you, or sent to Naples. Let me not, since I have my dukedom got, and pardon the deceiver, dwell in this bare island by your spell, but release me from my bands with the help of your good hands. Gentle breath of yours my sails must fill, or else my project fails, which was to please. Now I want spirits to enforce, art to enchant, and my ending is despair, unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free.